that God holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as unworthy of nothing else but to be cast into fire. You are 10,000 times so abominable in his eyes as the most hateful and venomous serpent in ours. There is laid in the very nature of carnal men a foundation for the torments of hell.
This quote from Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, evokes both sadness and anger as it fails spectacularly to reflect the loving heart of God and the inherent value placed upon God's creation. Perhaps no modern church dogma has been more destructive to the mission of Jesus, created more atheists, or generated more religious trauma than that of eternal conscious torment for the non-believer. This podcast's aim is to bring together experts in their fields to take the listener on a historical, philosophical, and theological journey to deconstruct this harmful doctrine. Along the way, the listener will not only be offered pathways to reconstruct a compelling perspective of final punishment, but ways to heal and move beyond the dire impact of eternal conscious torment indoctrination. Thank you for listening as you join us in our journey, the journey towards deconstructing hell. Well, hello, friends, and welcome to the Deconstructing Hell podcast. This podcast miniseries has been created as a companion to the book by the same title, Deconstructing Hell, Open and Relational Responses to the Doctrine of Eternal Conscious Torment, edited by Chad Ball and published by Sacrosage Press. The show is brought to you in partnership with the Rethinking Faith podcast, hosted by yours truly, Josh Patterson. And today I have joining me the author behind chapter number 14 of our book titled A Gospel of Hope, A Gentle Parenting Approach to Deconstructing Hell, and authored by Elizabeth Enns Peters. Liz, how are we doing today?
Hey, I'm good. It's actually pronounced Petters, but everyone...
Petters! I blew it.
Everyone pronounces it Peters. I get that all the time.
Well, I apologize for not asking before we started recording. Gosh,
no. I get that all of the time. And then if I don't correct people later, they're like, why did you not correct me? Right. Tell me I was wrong.
I had a similar experience recently. I was doing an episode for my podcast. And the guest that I had on, the first time I interviewed them, which was back in like 2020, I called them Matthias the entire time. And then introduced them as Matthias. And he was like, hey, Josh, like, I should have told you last time, but my name is Matthias.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I felt so bad. And then, like, definitely some not great words came out of my mouth. And so we restarted our conversation. But he was very gracious. And I, you know, kind of joking with him over and out, you know, over enunciated his name.
Yeah, you do that once, and then before every podcast, you're like, wait, I just want to check. How do I pronounce this? Is this all okay?
Right. It's embarrassing.
I've done that before, too, for sure. Totally right. Get it.
Good deal. Well, I appreciate your graciousness for my poor pronunciations of last names. But So, I guess kind of to jump in to the book that you wrote a chapter for, our Deconstructing Hell book. I'm curious before I go there, let's start with a little bit about you. This is my ADHD brain getting off track. So if you would, could you share a little bit about yourself, like who you are and what kind of things you find yourself doing?
My gosh, yeah. I right now am very much in... podcasting mode. I started a podcast with my co-host, who also wrote a chapter in this book, Esther Getz, a couple years ago, called Deconstructing Mamas. And so a lot of what I'm doing right now kind of revolves around that podcast and some other work that we're doing in that space. Just trying to support parents who are deconstructing and reconstructing faith, who are also trying to parent at the same time, but are using different techniques, and it's really confusing and scary. And so a lot of what I'm doing is that. I'm also a mom to two little kids who are 3 and 5. So I'm juggling working and being around them, which is crazy and fun. I love like theater on the side. So that's just like a fun little tidbit about me. I just like love musical theater. And so, I randomly will just like do shows in the area, and that's been really, really fun for me. So, that's just kind of a fun fact. Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot about me, but that's like just in a nutshell.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks. I really appreciate the work, that you all are doing with, Deconstructing Mamas. I get asked parenting questions, by some of my listeners, and I'm like, I don't have any kids, and I also have the same questions for when I do have kids. And so I think it's like an added layer of complexity, right? I mean, it's not my experience, so I can't fully speak to it, but it seems like you already have maybe kind of this faith shift or deconstruction you're trying to figure out, and then trying to be a good mom or dad at the same time. It's like, oh, what do you do? So I think the work you guys are doing is really important. So thanks for putting your energies into a project like that.
Yeah. I mean, we largely started it because I was like, I need this. I need a place like this. I don't know what I'm doing. And so that's kind of how it started. And it's been like wonderfully healing for me as well. So it's been a great space.
Yeah, I think it's cool. And I think one piece of advice that I've heard in regards to parenting stuff that kind of really stuck with me, in that realm of like the deconstruction stuff, was something that Trip Fuller, if you're familiar with him,
yeah.
He was on they did like a parenting panel at like a live event, and he was talking about, because people were asking like, oh, well, is it good to still like use Bible stories with our kids, or like, you know, this kind of thing. And Tripp kind of went on this point about the importance of story, and how story shapes us. And he was like, if you think penal substitutionary atonement is bad, wait until capitalism tells your kid who they are.
Hmm.
You know, wait until a society tells your kid that, you know, they're only as good as what they can achieve or something like that. And so kind of the pitch he was giving was that has to be a better story than the one that like TikTok gives, or the one that, you know, capitalism or whatever is giving. And for him, he found that story in kind of the theopoetics of the Christian faith, which doesn't necessarily be an answer for everybody. But I just thought that the story thing for me was interesting. That was really helpful, like thinking through what kind of story do I want to tell my kids?
Yeah, I love that too. I love that thought though too about like the story, right? Like if we're looking at certain Bible stories as stories, right? It definitely changes the way that we talk about them and the way that we're communicating them to young minds versus like this is absolute truth, right? So I think that does change it a ton. I love that. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's my I have no kids parenting thing that I stole from someone else. But
thank you, Trip.
Yeah, thank you, Trip. All right, so in regards to deconstructing hell, when Chad approached you and was like, yo, I would like you to write a chapter for this book, what kind of motivated you to say yes? Why did you want to be a part of this project?
Yeah, it's actually funny because when Chad originally contacted me, my book club and I were reading God Can't by Thomas Ord, and we're like, you know, dissecting it and reading it and like absorbing it and like all of these wonderful things that you do with that. I mean, it's just so good. And so when he contacted me, I was sort of like, it just was a sort of weird thing. He was like, I'm contacting you. Like, you know, like I'm a student under Thomas Ord and this is what we're doing. And so initially it kind of caught my eye because of the fact that we were sort of already doing this Thomas Ord book. But for me, in my deconstructing, reconstructing, evolving faith journey, whatever we're calling it, hell was like one of the most massive things that I had to deconstruct, this idea of eternal conscious torment and what that meant for me. And now as an older person, like looking back on my childhood, what that meant for me as a child and my child development. And it's been a really, really big piece of my journey. And so to be a part of a book that is just sort of having an open conversation about this, felt like a healing opportunity for me, and also just a really huge honor.
Yeah, that's awesome. I again, you know, to bring up the story, I like how you kind of couch that in story, like this is my own story. And so, you know, kind of keep telling that. But with you mentioned it a little bit. So my assumption is eternal conscious torment is the quick answer to this. But what kind of was your relationship to hell growing up? Was it something very explicitly taught? Was it more implicit? Like, how did it impact you emotionally? Those kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think in my home environment. So, I mean, a lot of you know my dad is Peter Enns. So, you know, in my home environment, we didn't really talk about hell all that much. I didn't feel like I was getting the message from my parents, like, do this and you're going to hell. But it was something that I was definitely absorbing from my church environment at a very, very young age. I remember being, I 4 or 5, in Sunday school, we went to a church that met at like an old folks' home. I remember this very specifically. We're sitting at this round table, and it was when I first accepted Jesus into my heart with some prayer, with some words, right? And I remember so specifically in that moment feeling like, okay, good, I did it, I'm safe. And then in the next moment feeling like, wait a second, how is this make me safe? Like, how does this make me, what about that makes me safe, right? And what about all those other people that didn't say that prayer? You know, all these questions sort of start coming up that we as adults even, you know, ask. But as a child, to really start thinking through this idea of, okay, if that's a possibility, right? If hell is a possibility, if burning in this underworld forever is a possibility, what would really make me free from that? You know, like, is this prayer to a God? Am I saying the right words? Did I do it enough times? Am I too young to really understand? Do I need to do it again? Did it stick? Do I actually need to be baptized? Like, do I need to save a bunch of other souls in order for it to fit? Like, the list goes on and on, right? There was just never really any, there was never really any feeling of security. And I think a lot of fear and anxiety for me, not fully revolved around that concept, but I think a lot of it revolved around this concept. Because with that hanging over your head, how can you ever freaking relax ever? Right.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like this, existential dread, but at like such a young age.
Yeah.
I can relate to that, so much, just that idea, especially the story, it seems like, that so many of us share is like this kind of like doing this prayer that was supposed to be so magical and impactful over and over and over and over and over again. Right. Like, I remember every year at when we would like go to the youth retreat, every time they did the altar call, like I went up every time just to be sure, because I really didn't know if like it was going to work or not. So that, yeah, that existential dread really does seem to be kind of like a common theme that people share. Man.
Yeah, I mean, I would go as far as to say, you know, it's a pretty traumatic thing to learn about and then internalize at a young age. And like you said, it carries on through those teenage years. You know, you drank too much at a party a week before, you go on this retreat, and then you really gotta, like, you really gotta win God back, right? Because you just really messed up. And so it consumes your thoughts. I mean, even as an adult, I can remember back to things, you know, even 5 or 6 years ago, where I had to stop myself from saying like, oh my gosh, right? Like, is this gonna condemn me?
Yeah, that's interesting. And as you were thinking, I just had like a new thought come to mind, a connection, if you will. I don't know if it actually makes sense or not. I'll share it with you and then you can decide if it makes sense or not. So I know like there's this work around the hell, like they call it the hell anxiety scale. which was like, you know, legit research that went in, and they basically use it as like a psychological tool to help kind of like map people where they kind of fell on this. And one thing that they found is that people who claim to, like adults who claim to believe in eternal conscious torment in hell also don't believe that they're going there. And so there's this interesting cognitive dissonance where it seems like adults, if they believe that, also at the same time don't believe that they're going there, because that would be too much. You can't live that way, right? You would be freaking out. But as a child, where you take things so literally and seriously, like probably the, I don't know that the op, like that that's would be true for them. They may very well believe, like actually believe like, oh shit, am I actually like, I'm going to this place. So it seems like maybe for children, it impacts them differently. I don't know. Again, not a parent. I'd be interested if that seems like it maybe makes sense anecdotally. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I feel like that's a little bit of like a mic drop moment. I also just want to point out, like, you might not be a parent, but you have been a child. Like, you have been parented. You know what I mean? And so it's like, even for our podcast, I say sometimes, like, I mean, this is a parenting podcast, but we all need to be reparented. We have all been children, like, you know, and so on some levels, like, we do have this understanding of like what kids needed, right? Like what we need as a child, what kids might need, and what felt unsafe. And I think, yeah, I think that on some level as children, we do sort of almost in an odd way ground ourselves in reality like differently than adults do. I think as adults we've like learned to really like disassociate and, like you said, sort of like disengage from the things that are like creepy and that we just can't handle, right? And for kids, I think like they don't do that. There's this innocence. They hear something and they absorb it, right? And so like you hear that there's a possibility, right, that somebody could go to this place, and your initial thought is like, well, if it could be them, it could be me. Because that just makes logical sense, right? And so it does. It creates this fear, this really deep-seated fear in these sort of like innocent minds trying to figure out like who they are as people and how they different from other people. And it's really complicated. Like on a developmental level, it's really, really complicated.
Yeah, so interesting. This makes me want to like get a psychology degree. I find it fascinating.
Same. I think about it every day.
Right? So it seems, I mean, maybe it's rather clear and apparent based off the kind of like podcasting work that you do, and also the fact that like, you know, you are a parent, kind of going through these like deconstruction, faith shifting stuff. But I'm curious if there's like maybe anything else, or maybe there's not, I don't know, as to why, because your chapter was about gentle parenting, and so you wanted to bring parenting into the kind of conversation here. I mean, again, perhaps it's rather obvious based off the kind of work that you do, but is there anything else around that maybe you'd like to share as to why you wanted to write your chapter on parenting specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think my deconstructing journey really took off after I had my first child. So she's almost six. But when she was first born, and even the first year of her life, we had her dedicated at church. I was sort of like one foot in, one foot out, not sure really what I believed, was writing kind of like some progressive stuff that people kind of like, I would write these sort of like progressive things for like devotionals or something they'd ask me to do for Easter. And then like everyone would kind of, there'd be like crickets, people would be reading them and they'd be like, you know. So I was sort of like one foot in, one foot out, but wasn't really ready to let go of certain things about my religious upbringing. And there was like some specific moment, probably when my daughter was 1.5 or 2, where I just realized that I didn't want her to be in Sunday school. And again, personal choice, right? Like everyone makes their own decisions. I'm not telling anybody what to do, but for me personally, I felt like I don't want her to absorb any of this information, like outside of me overseeing it, right? Not that I think I have all the answers, but I wanted to guide that journey and I didn't want someone else to do it. And at this point, I had already really largely deconstructed this idea of, you know, hell and some other doctrine that I had kind of grown up with. And so it was just really important to me that my kids didn't have that background noise. And I think probably that will shift maybe as they get older. But what I really started diving into when I didn't have that sort of faith piece holding me up as a parent, right? Like I wasn't clinging to my church community in the same way. I wasn't utilizing Bible stories to sort of lead my kids in a certain direction just because of my own personal choice. So I really started focusing on like how I can just intentionally parent them as human beings. Like how can I look at them as human beings who are spiritual just because they were born, right? And how can I listen and learn and grow? And that to me became sort of like just my spiritual journey with my kids, kind of went all into sort of like that basket. And what I started to find, and intentional parenting is really hard. A lot of people are doing that now, right? Like we're not spanking our kids. We're trying to listen and hear, right? It's not just me. This is like very mainstream. But one thing that I really, experienced as I started to at least try and do this with my kids, is that they like responded better to, this more gentle, intentional parenting than they did when I would yell at them or when I would kind of hold something over their head, right? Like, no TV if you don't, blah, 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 which we all do. But they just didn't respond well to that. And they responded very well to this other way of parenting. And it really started me thinking about like, if God is sort of the ultimate parent, you know, some would say, right, God the Father, if God is the ultimate parent, but isn't parenting us this way, like, why not? Like, why not? Why would he not be? Like, that didn't make sense to me. And so I really just started thinking about that. And so when, like, Chad kind of gave me the opportunity to do this chapter, that was just the immediate place that I went, because that's sort of the journey that I'm on. As I'm parenting my own kids and as I'm reparenting my own self and working through a lot of my own traumas, I just no longer can believe that God would not have the same sense of like love and safety and like gentle guidance that I desire to have for my own kids. It just doesn't make sense to me anymore. And so most of my faith is like comes out of the way that I'm parenting right now.
Yeah, I like it. It's interesting. I love the idea too of like if, you know, I think it's a rather controversial claim that, you know, within most Christian spaces to say God is love. but oftentimes I feel like people like caveat that too much or like make it not look like love. And to steal another, you know, phrase from Tripp, he always likes to say God has to be at least as nice as Jesus, right? and so, yeah, the kind of idea, if we use this like parental imagery for God, like, you know, the scriptures do, then yeah, why wouldn't God match be better than the best kind of parenting tools and models that we have? So
right.
Yeah, makes sense to me.
And if not, then I'm out. Like, I'm like, if he's not like this, then I'm out. Like, I'm, you know, so like, I'd rather put all my eggs in this basket. Cause like, I'm not doing the other thing anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I love to kind of you use this phrase a few times when you were speaking in talking about journeying with your kids. And that stood out to me for whatever reason. I like that. That imagery seems a lot more healthy than just this kind of maybe rather an opposing perspective would be more of this like top down, like hierarchical kind of parenting model, but the journeying with feels more organic and also just more healthy. So I don't know. You said that a few times and that jumped out at me. So I like that idea.
I think if we really if we see our kids as born kind of pure and innocent, which, you know, not everyone does, right? Some people believe that we're born wicked. But if you really believe that we are intrinsically good, right, and that we all have purpose and meaning just because we exist, then you're going to look at other people, including your children, you know, that way. And so I feel like I learn a lot from them, you know? I mean, I don't believe that I know everything, for sure. And I try to approach parenting in that way. You know, it's not that I'm completely permissive and just let them do whatever they want. And we have like a free for all at our house, for sure not. And I get it wrong a lot of times. Right. But you know, if I have an afternoon where I'm really loud and cranky, my daughter sometimes will look at me with fear in her eyes and say, "You are scaring me, mommy." And I welcome that. I never want my kids to feel that way. Right. But I am human. But those are the kind of moments where I look at this God that I believe in. Right. And this God that I experience around in the world around me and in the people around me and in myself. And I just cannot believe that God would ever want to scare the shit out of me. Can I say shit? Scare me. What can we say here? You know, I just,
that's
I just,
up to I Chad. Okay, I'm fine well, with it. Go for
we
it.
Can add it if we need to, but scare me. Right. And so I think journeying with my kids, I think, like you said, it's been just really, really organic because right now I'm asking a ton of questions and many of them are the same questions that they're asking. And so we are kind of learning together. And yeah, it's an interesting journey. It's definitely an interesting journey.
Yeah. One other thing you had said too is kind of this assumption, you know, you brought up like anthropology, like how we look at people and, you know, looking at kids as innocent and pure, but also you made a really interesting point about, you said something like our children are like born spiritual or like something along those lines. I really like that. And I think there's like really good research to kind of back that up too. What is her name? Hold on, forgive me. I broke a rule and walked away from a microphone when podcasting should do that. Lisa Miller, I believe is her name. She's written a book about just that and kind of like this. It's almost like spirituality or like that it is hardwired into people and it's inherent in children. And I, you know, I think Jesus talks about this too, right? Like, you know, having faith of a child, maybe, or something like that. But anyway, that kind of, you know, sparked or piqued my antennas as well. Just kind of even just the assumptions that we bring into, like, what is a child? We, you know, is going to change and impact how we interact with them and how we parent them. So,
right. Yeah. And we've kind of lost, I mean, we're just so intellectual, right? And like, we know too much, you know? So I think like unpacking that and being able to sit outside and look at a butterfly for 5 minutes, you know, because my kids want to look at a butterfly for 5 minutes, just completely changes the way that I view God. And I think the way that I experience God, it's so much less intentional in the best way. It's literally, you're literally just living life and believing that God is within you. It takes so much of the pressure off and it's so much less exhausting and there's this purity to it. So that's where we are right now. We're trying to take it simple.
I love it. Sounds like we got a household of mystics on our hands. That's pretty fun.
We might.
I love it. I love it. I like to, sometimes refer to myself as an aspiring mystic, like contemplative practice and the like finding God in the ordinary, like you're describing, was a really big kind of shift in my faith for me and something that has been really helpful in my own, journey of becoming, as I like to call it. But anyway, within your kind of this like gentle parenting model that you've been talking about, you offered 4 different, I don't know if you want to call them like axioms or ideas, concepts, whatever, empathy, respect, understanding, and boundaries. And I thought maybe it would be fun if we kind of like go through them and talk a little bit, and you can maybe share like what it is and how you might find that helpful within this gentle parenting model. So why don't we start with empathy?
Yeah. I mean, empathy is largely important, you know, both in how we relate to other people, but I think also in the way that we see Jesus relating to other people. And I talked about that a little bit in my chapter. I mean, empathy, respect, understanding, and boundaries are sort of like the four just kind of like most basic, use it axioms, you know, whatever we want to call them, of gentle parenting. So like, this is what professionals would, if you say like, what's gentle parenting, professionals would say, oh, well, it's these like four things, you know, logically, right? And so I just thought, you know, okay, why don't I just take those four things, right, that we believe to be the core of this gentle, intentional parenting and talk about them. But empathy to me is the most important. And I think the one that, we miss a lot in our relationship to each other. And I think even just like as a church and as like a American Christian community, you know, we really miss this idea of empathy. We're kind of bogged down with this idea of absolute truth and knowing things and making sure that everyone lands in our camp and making sure that everything is right all the time. And we miss this like this human to human connection and just the ability to see someone else's experience and to be able to look at someone and say, you know, like we see you basically, right? Like, I don't always understand what you're saying. But we see you. And in the chapter, I touched briefly on just the story of Lazarus, because I just feel like that's just such a really very easy, simple story that I feel like just loudly proclaims Jesus's empathy. You know, Jesus knew that Lazarus was dying, right? He says that he knows this, right? And then he goes to this place and he's overwhelmed by grief and weeping along with the people around him because he knows that they're in pain. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure people can argue other things and that's fine. But I think that we see this play out in a couple different spaces in the Bible. And I think just as human beings, we can even just say like, we see how this plays out when we relate to other people. And this is a real, beneficial characteristic to have, I guess, to like, put it plainly, right? Like empathy is important. So I think, you know, we as humans, it's important for us as humans to have empathy. But I also feel like it's this characteristic that we see Jesus have, which in my mind, connecting Jesus with God, it feels just in some senses very obvious that God would also approach us, you know, in this similar way with empathy. So I think I kind of tie Jesus to God in a lot of different instances, to sort of help bridge that gap a little bit. Cause I think sometimes it's easier to look at Jesus as a human being, right? Which most of us believe, even historically, if you don't believe like religiously, right? That Jesus was a human being, was a person that lived. And so, yeah, I think it's just helpful to make that connection. I don't know. Did I answer your question on empathy? I feel like I got like long-winded there, but.
No, it's good. Long-windedness is welcome, but I think I appreciate it. I appreciate it. I did not perceive it as long-winded, but the empathy piece, I'm with you, is super important. And even recently in a conversation I was having actually with Matthias, the person that, you know, we started off with me mispronouncing their name, and in his new book, one of the things he was talking about is how empathy has actually been explicitly taught as a negative characteristic within some Christian circles. And he was referencing basically in his book, he was referencing like Desiring God articles and like Gospel Coalition, like this flavor of Christianity, and how they talk about empathy is actually this dangerous thing, because when you're empathetic, it will lead you away from God's truth. Right? Because God forbid you have empathy for a gay person or something like that. Right. And so,
right.
I don't know. I want to distance myself from that and say, no, you guys are wrong. Empathy is really great for all the reasons that you just said. But also too, just to couch in story, empathy is the thing, you know, maybe the Gospel Coalition people got this right. That really did has like shifted a lot of my thoughts and opinions in regards to some of my like not just theology, but even like politics or whatever, right? Like my relationships that I have with my gay and trans and queer friends has done something to me. And I think positively, in the same way that like my relationships with people who believe differently than me or look differently than me or whatever, that empathy, I just really think is key. And so, yeah, I'm with you. I think it's super duper important.
Yeah, I think you made a really good point there. Like empathy, I think, can at times threaten the idea of absolute truth, right? Because if we're like moving towards empathy with all beings, and then we're not focusing on saving them. Like, how could we, right? Like we're wasting time. We're just empathizing and we're not saving. And like, we need to just, you know, be mean enough to get them to heaven. And so I do think that there's a piece of it, and right, this isn't a blanket statement for all, you know, all evangelicals or, but I do think there's a piece of it where empathy can be really threatening or can feel really threatening, because it feels so very human. Right. And that's not always applauded.
Yes. All right. I think that right there, that's a mic drop, to use your language. The empathy feels human. I love it. That's like, Twitter's, I guess, not a thing, threads worthy. Anyway, the next thing that, you know, the axioms or whatever we're calling them, is respect, which I think ties nicely into empathy. So where do you see kind of respect, playing into this, like, parenting conversation?
Yeah. Respect is one of those things that, you know, I think a lot of people that I'm talking to who are deconstructing now or who grew up in a more conservative religious environment, you know, one of the most common things I hear is like throughout their childhood, they're hearing like, you will not disrespect me, right? From authority figures or parents or whatever, like you will be respectful. You will not disrespect me. And, you know, while I think there's obviously places, you know, where it's important that we respect each other, I think that's like the important piece, right? Is we're respecting each other. And so when we're talking about parenting specifically, and we're talking about, you know, how I'm parenting my kids and how many people are moving towards parenting their kids right now, it's again, seeing them as people, as human beings, right? They're young and their brains are still forming. There's a lot of things they need to learn, but they're still human beings and they deserve respect just like we deserve respect. And so, it's when you start to look at it that way, and then when you start to sort of translate it to this idea of, you know, God the Father, us as children, right? There's this idea of mutual respect. And again, I know I said earlier, you know, when I'm parenting my kids in this specific way with these specific attributes, you know, empathy, respect, understanding, boundaries, they respond much more positively, not all the time, right? But they respond much more positively than some of the other ways of parenting from you know what I've learned. And so again, it feels like, okay, if this is something that children need from parents, then we also must need that from God. Right. And studies are backing this research, right, about what children need. So God is not an idiot. Like, God does not somehow not have this information, not know this information. This is not new information. So God must have already been doing it, right, this entire time. I think, I don't know if it's just because it's something that I've been hashing out in my brain for so long, but for me, it just feels so obvious. Like, where have I been this entire time? Like, of course, if this is how tiny little innocent children like need from, if this is what they need from me, then this is also what I need from God. And if I'm seeing my children as precious enough to receive this, then God is seeing me as precious enough to receive that as well. And so that's been really, really healing.
Yeah, no, I love it. And I think that just, and you do it like throughout your chapter, but that shift in perspective about God, I know for me, was a massive turning point in my own kind of, you know, faith journey. Because the God that I was handed growing up, like, I didn't want to know that God. That God was like scary and kind of a dick. And yeah, so, and why would I want to be a part of that? And so, yeah, I don't know. I'll have to say I'm here for it. And I don't remember if it was in the section when you were talking about respect, but you kind of, you made this point that, and because also you've been saying how when you apply these four things, your children respond better. But you made this point where it's saying it's essentially, it's not about control that kind of motivates and gets us to do things, but rather about love and nurture. And I don't know, I thought that point was really important. And it just echoes, like, you know, other science-based research, like you're saying, like when you tell somebody that they're a giant piece of trash, that doesn't actually change people and transform them. It's not until people are seen and known and loved and valued, then transformation happens. And so I think that kind of idea is like mapping into this conversation with parenting and our understanding of God.
Yeah, no, I think that's great that you pulled that, because that was a huge piece of what I was saying. And, you know, obviously, like, we don't know what God is like. Like, I'm not sitting here saying, like, well, yes, I have, like, a degree in, like, godly attributes, and, like, I know exactly how God is, right? But we're taking, like, the knowledge, right, that we're absorbing from other humans who know child development, right, who know, like, what people need and the nurturing that they need. And we're saying, okay, if God is love, right, if God is just pure love, and these things are loving, then God is going to apply those to, you know, their relationships as well, right? Whatever God's relationships look like, but that they're going to apply that way as well. But let me just, I want to read this like little piece from my book, because I'm going to butcher it if I don't, from the chapter. Kind of based on what you were saying, Josh, like, respect is a gateway to healthy relationships. When we're respected, we feel safe, heard, and known. When I'm not respected by someone, I shut down or I run. I don't stand by and hear what they have to say. We can't disrespect others and expect them to trust us. Jesus knew this, and God knows this. And I talked a little bit about, you know, Jesus at the well with the Samaritan woman and his respect for her and how it kind of like opened up the conversation. But I think it's true. If someone disrespects me, I cannot hear them. Like, I cannot hear them. And the relationship is broken. So without respect, there's nothing there. What there is there's an abusive relationship. That's what there is if there's no respect, right? And so if there's no respect in my relationship with God, then what's happening, in my opinion, is abuse. And I'm not here for that. And I don't believe that that's who God is.
Yeah, Common Hymnal has this song called God Is Not Abusive. And I don't know, I always liked that song. I found it helpful. And I'm not like, definitely not a big proponent of Christian music. It's not my favorite thing. Even when I was a pastor, it wasn't my favorite thing in the world. But Common Hymnal has some bangers, and God Is Not Abusive was one of them. So I'll echo you there. So the next one was understanding. So in parenting, where does understanding come in?
Yeah, I mean, understanding is a little similar to empathy in some ways, because you're really just being sympathetically, you know, aware of somebody's feelings. But I think the thing about understanding is that it doesn't really require us to agree with someone, right? There, it doesn't have to be agreement. There just has to be presence. So there's a lot of people that I, you know, that have differences than I do, right? That I'm working to understand. There might not be some common belief system that we're united under, but I'm respecting them enough, right? And I'm empathizing with them enough to take that next step of just understanding where they're coming from, understanding what their life has looked like, understanding what things have led them to this place, and then being able to just listen, you know, without interrupting, and just be in a space with them without an ulterior motive, I think is mostly what understanding looks like to me. And I think at times, I mean, I didn't really write about this specifically in the book. I think maybe I would have put it in there if I had a little bit more writing room. But, you know, if God is understanding of who we are, there's room for mistakes, right? And there's room for humanity and there's room for growth. And there isn't just like kind of like a gavel in the sky, like waiting to come down on top of us, because we're free to just be ourselves and to be human and to know that it's safe to do so. And that God isn't going to somehow be caught off guard, you know, that we're people, like, you know, somehow we have to be like divine. It's like, no, we're like, right. We're just people. We're like just doing what we do every day and we're just trying our best. And I think again, like that's just another piece of the relationship portion where if there's understanding, right, and you feel safe to be yourself with someone, you're going to want to spend time with that person. You're going to be in awe of that person, right? And you're going to have this sort of like healthy relationship. And if that's true about God, right, then like that just changes the entire narrative, and the entire way that we relate to this divine being.
Yeah, I loved when you said that understanding is not necessarily agreement. That was kind of like a like light bulb for me. Like that's really good. And I think, I mean, this is slightly off topic, but I think that just even having that idea, understanding does not equal agreement, could help with something like cancel culture, where a lot of that result, and now don't hear me saying there aren't things that we should say this is bad and we should not do this and we should not stand for that. But I think in a lot of just the kind of like knee-jerk cancel culture stuff, there is a lack of understanding. And so if we could seek to understand, which again, as you said, doesn't mean agree with, I think that could be helpful. And then also, I love that you said that like God understands what it's like to be human. I think we get that in the incarnation, right? Basic Christian belief. But also, if I can, this is me sneaking in my process relational theology into creative ways. within my perspective, as a process relational thinker, the divine, like when I literally fully understands what it means to be human in all aspects, because I, there's many reasons, too many to unpack, but basically, like, I think God fully knows what it feels like to be Josh Patterson in all of its entirety. And that has a whole bunch of metaphysical assumptions and stuff baked in, but that kind of relationship, which is another key thing that keeps coming up here in this conversation, that I see you really see you focusing on, but that relational aspect with the divine, I think, is huge. And so that, I don't know, those just some thoughts on understanding as you're speaking.
I love that. I love the metaphysical stuff. I feel like I've been really getting into, yeah. I'm on tangents at this point. Like I'm off in like all different directions, like in my own kind of like healing journey. But I love that piece. And I got actually chills when you said that piece, that like God literally knows what it's like to be you specifically, right? And like I just think that's so, so powerful. If you can imagine a divine being that literally understands every bit of you, like that's just so beautiful and so healing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, God is closer to us than we are to our own breath. And we exist here. Here's will be my fancy nerd words. We humans and all of creation exist objectively in the divine memory forever. And one more thing, just to steal another phrase that fits in here. Richard Rohr likes to say that God loves things by becoming them. And I think that's really big incarnational language right there, which seems to be a pretty basic Christian doctrine that the church has forgotten.
I love that. I love that. Yeah, so true. It's so, so true.
Cool. All right. So here, help me with this one, because boundaries is something I am bad at. I tend to not have healthy boundaries in the sense that I overshare and I let people walk all over me sometimes. So yeah. how can healthy boundaries help us here?
Well, friend, I also overshare, which I am learning now is in some senses it can be a little bit of a trauma response. I also feel like sometimes oversharing is really healing for me. Like, I had a therapist tell me one time that I'm her only client that she says, go on social media and share your life. Like, I'm like the only client that she would suggest that to, because like that for me is really healing to sort of share my story. And anyways, I digress. Boundaries. I think boundaries it's something that we literally do not talk about in the Christian faith. Like, we actually don't talk about it. And it's more than probably any of these things that we're talking about here, right? Like, I think most people kind of get behind them. When you start talking about boundaries, people go, oh, well, you're not loving people if you don't, like, if you're pushing them away. Or like, but you're not being like a good servant of Christ if you're saying like no to serving on Sunday, or, you know, whatever. But boundaries are super, super huge to being able to be like a full, heal, whole person. And then also, like, if we're talking about serving people, being able to serve people well in the capacity that we are able, right? Boundaries are, they're physical, they're emotional, they're spiritual. I mean, boundaries are huge, and they're here to protect us. You know, they're here to sort of like usher us towards healing and wholeness. But I feel like it's something that I'm trying to teach my children, but also trying to learn myself. So this is one of those things that I think is tricky for a lot of us who grew up in the faith, because you know, other people were just like always first, you know, so like you didn't really matter. You didn't really need to sort of have boundaries and know kind of your own needs. And so I'm working with my kids, I think, to develop really healthy boundaries and not feel guilty for having those boundaries. And I remember, I wrote about this a little bit in my chapter, but I remember as a kid, you know, constantly wondering, like, why didn't Jesus just like heal everybody? Like, why did he even sleep? Like, why did he even do anything other than just like heal people? Right. Like, as a little kid, you like, all you see, right, all you're told about is there's this dude that could literally heal people, and he's like asleep in like a mountain. Like, he's just like, what is he doing? Right. And, so that was, I remember thinking that like very, very early on. And a couple years ago, like pretty still early on in my deconstruction journey. And, you know, I was reading through, I don't know, something and, the Bible and, was just coming across like a lot of passages where Jesus was just like resting, right? Like just resting, and like refueling and praying and separating from the disciples and separating from these crowds of people and these multitudes of people. And I remember that really sticking out to me as like, oh, like, so this guy was like sort of an introvert, right? And then was okay with that. Okay enough to say, sorry, guys, not everyone's going to be healed because like I have to take care of myself, right? Like, that's just how my mind was processing it. But it's something that has kind of stuck with me. And when I feel like off course, or when I feel guilty for prioritizing my own healing, right, I kind of go back to this, that sort of initial moment where I was like, wait a second, but Jesus was resting, right? Like, which I think is really, it's just really, really important. And kind of reiterates this idea that like Jesus, right, knew what it was like to be human. God understands what it's like to be human and like what our needs are as humans. And so we have like every right to set some of those boundaries. But yeah, the idea of like self-care, right, and like the idea of saying no to things that aren't okay. A lot of people feel like, you know, just don't, they can't get on board with that, 'cause that just feels like, counter Christian, I think, in a lot of ways. But if God is within us, and if we are connected with God in this deep, deep sense that I feel like we are, healing ourselves is this deeper healing for the universe in a way, right? Like, let's go metaphysical stuff, but it's this deeper healing, right? It's not really just about us, right? It feels about just about us on like this sort of like human level, but it's about way more than that. We're healing generational trauma. We're healing, right? Like, we're healing sort of all of these things. So I know I could kind of go on and on about this, because I feel like boundaries are just so important, and they're just so, I don't think I ever had a boundary in my life until I was like 27 years old. Like, just had no clue that you were allowed to just like not do things that didn't feel good for you.
Oh, yeah, that's good. And I am with you. I am trying to figure out boundaries currently. But one thing that when you were saying there too, that just got me excited. This idea about how healing ourselves is like in a deep way healing the universe as a whole. That reminds me of like Jesus's bit about like, what you do to the least of these, you do unto me. And why I say that is because, so from my metaphysical perspective, again, within a process relational framework, everything is like truly deeply interconnected. It's viewed, instead of as like subject object, it's more organic and relational. And so, for example, now if someone was to tell the story of Josh Patterson, they would not be able to tell it fully without telling now your story, right? Because we have this relationship now where we have this, do this podcast conversation together. And so the full story of who I am is now incomplete without this, whatever podcast we're doing, being included. Yeah. And so everything kind of works that way. And so it's not that the individual is not important and just the whole is important, but it's rather the individual isn't known fully outside of the whole, in the same way that if we were to pull an individual out of that whole, the whole would no longer be whole. So in a very real way, when we are working for healing in ourselves, we are healing the whole because we are a part of it. And so like, I hold to that in like a deep, like core metaphysical space. Like, I think when Jesus said, what you do unto the least of these, you do unto me. I think he meant that shit like very seriously, but also you could expand it and say, what you do unto me, you do unto yourself, what you do unto yourself, you do unto your neighbor, etc. And that kind of like, to use a woo-woo word, Christ consciousness, that interconnection, I think, is often lost. And anyway, that's not specifically about boundaries, but yeah. You got me going.
Yeah, I mean, ADHD. I felt like I was similarly though. I like started on boundaries and then I ended up like over here. But I think like to kind of like bring it back to the boundaries piece, like, I mean, you could probably imagine this, Josh, like as a kid, right? Like, what if somebody told you, like, if that doesn't feel right for you, like, you don't have to do that. And that is like, not only is it okay, but that's like okay with God, right? Like, I just think that that would have been a total game changer for me, right? Like, I never felt like I could say no. I never felt like I could question the things that were taught to me. You know, at least especially in like church settings. I mean, I think we had conversations in our home. But as I'm parenting my own kids, you know, teaching them to value themselves enough to say no, right? And for that to be a deeply spiritual practice could be a major like game changer, major shift for an entire generation, right? Like, if we're all sort of trying to parent in this similar way, there could be this major shift where people, they say no to the things that don't serve them and say yes to the things that do, and are able to put their being into these, you know what I'm talking about? Like, it's like, if you have the boundaries, these really beautiful things are coming out of it because you're able to focus on like what is actually for you to be doing, right? Like, which I think, I mean, I can't tell you like how many years I served in Sunday school because I felt like I couldn't say no. Like, you know what I mean? Like, but just kind of those sorts of like really simple ways of just saying like, no, this isn't work for me. I have to do something else, you know?
Yeah, I love that. The ability to say no is something I struggle with. But I'll wrap up the boundaries bit with this. I saw as you were speaking, I was reminded.
It's 8 p.m. people. Everybody's a little.
I was reminded of a post I saw on, I think, Facebook today, where someone was sharing an experience that they were at like an amusement park, and there was a father and his kid in front of him, and they were in line for a roller coaster.
Yes, and... it was Glennon Doyle shared that.
Oh, okay, she shared that. Yes. Yeah. That's exactly right. Go ahead. You're right. Yeah, and basically the father told the child that, like, hey, getting on this roller coaster is very brave of you, but also telling me that you don't want to get on this roller coaster is very brave of you. And I was like, that is good parenting right there. I'm going to write that shit down for future reference.
Yes.
That's like healthy boundary setting. Yeah.
Yeah, that's. I feel like that's been circulating, and every time I see that, I'm just like, yes. Like, yes. Like, and again, it's like that idea of like, you don't really have to do anything that doesn't feel good to you to please other people. And that kind of goes back to the God thing, right? Like, we don't have to do all these things to like please God, right? It's like unnecessary to be doing all these things to please God at like our own expense. Like, we get the message that being this like major martyr, right, is like what's really gonna like win souls for the kingdom of God, or whatever the point is. But like, it's really not. Like, we actually don't have to.
Yeah. Amen. Speaking of amen, so you start your chapter with this, like, here's a really unhelpful way of looking at hell. Then you do this like really cool gentle parenting bit that we've been talking about. And the way you kind of wrap it up is with an altar call. Just kidding. You offer the last section in your chapter is called A Gospel of Hope, and you just paint this, you kind of tie all the threads together and paint this really beautiful picture there at the end of God and the gospel and all these kind of things. And so I was just wondering if you could paint that beautiful picture for the listeners.
Yeah, man. Listen, not to toot my own horn, but I just feel like I wrote it so beautifully. And now, like, I'm at 8 p.m. I'm gonna try and like reel back in. No, I think really for me, I think I know I talked about this a little bit in the beginning of the chapter, but just not feeling safe, right? Like, just this not feeling safe. And how horrific that feels, right? And what kept me coming back to God was this tiny glimmer of hope that, like, maybe God is actually safe. Like, maybe God is actually love in the way that I believe that love is, and in the way that my being longs to be loved. Like, maybe God is actually my longing, right? And that was something that I think kept me kind of in the darkest points of my faith, sort of clinging to God. And so I guess I really just like invite readers and listeners to kind of just like imagine that, right? Like, imagine if God is this safe place. Imagine if God is full of empathy, respects us, right? Like, God literally respects us as humans, understands us, allows us our own boundaries, and encourages us to have boundaries, right? Like, just imagine what that would be like. And as I'm parenting my own kids, and again, like, I do many, many things wrong, but in my best of moments as a parent, I'm like, this is what I need from God. Like, this is all I need. Like, right? Like, I need someone to tell me that it's okay. And I need someone to say, this shit sucks and I can't fix it for you. And I am sorry. Right? Like, that's what I need. Like, I don't need like a bunch of like just frou-frou that doesn't make any sense, right? Which is so much of like what I grew up with, was just like all of like just a lot of like talking, like just a lot of words, right? That just didn't make any actual sense with the human experience. But like, what if God is not like that? What if God is real and organic and kind beyond measure and the safest, softest place to possibly land? I've done, like, I don't know if some people who are listening maybe have done like healing prayer before, which is like something that I did back in my, you know, heavy evangelical days. And there was actually some really beautiful healing pieces to it, because really the idea is like it brings Jesus into these like hard, traumatic places in your life, right? And so at the beginning, like your first session, they say, find like a place in your mind where, you know, God is, like, find that place in your mind. And then when you go, when we talk through some of these hard things, like, go back to that place. And for me, it was like, when I thought of God, when I thought of Jesus, it was just this great sphere of white light, but the light was like soft, almost like a cloud. And I was just in this like long white, like just comfy robe, sitting in the middle, hugging my knees. And it was like the safest I'd ever felt in my life. But what if God is actually like that? Right? Like what if what we imagine God to be, like, is actually God? I'm saying the same thing over and over because I'm so passionate about it, because I just think like that could be true, guys. Like, that could actually be true. And there's so much freedom and peace and even like community around that idea if we just allow it to be, and allow ourselves to not need to have control of the narrative, right? And allow God to be just who God is without there being answers. That's the hard piece, right? Because like, if God is really like this, there's probably not going to be a lot of like answers, and there's probably not going to be like a lot of praying that's going to like pull you out of suffering. And like, you know, there's probably going to be certain, these like anecdotes that we have, like, probably aren't going to be real, but there's something else that's even more real. That's bigger than anything that like we ever imagined. So that's like, that's the hope for me. That's the hope for me. And, the truth is, you know, there's so many things that we are never going to know, and this is one of them. But I'm learning to trust my inner knowing, which I believe is the Holy Spirit, right? I believe that God is within me, and I'm learning to trust my inner knowing, and my inner knowing is saying, yes, this is God. That other stuff, that is not God. That is religion, some sort of religion, right? But that is not God. That is not God. Not to say there isn't room for, like, you know, religion, right? Not that there isn't room for different ways of thinking and experiencing whatever, but like, that is not God. And this is, and this has to be the most important thing, bigger than any theology. So that's what I'm clinging to right now.
Hell yeah. I echo that 100%. That's, I love it. I don't actually want to like add anything for fear of taking away, but it reminds me, like, I guess the invitation then is this beautiful image of God, that you have, and, you know, talk about, you experience, I just want to echo and say, like, that too is the God that I experience. And it took me a while to get to a place where I felt comfortable actually trying to get to know God, because I had all this fear and stuff built around it. But I know, and I'm taking this from my buddy Aaron Simmons, but he likes to say faith is risk in a direction. And so maybe an invitation to the listeners could be, take that risk. What if God really is that loving? Have faith that it's true, and risk yourself in that direction and see what happens.
Yeah, I know. I have a friend who says all the time, she's like, if hell is real, then I don't want any part of that God anyway, you know? And it's like, you know, I think you're right. I think that it's a risk. It's always a risk in the unknown, but we're unknown both ways, right? And risking in this direction has led me to a place of personal healing and more groundedness, and has shifted the way that I relate to other human beings. And that in itself feels like a win to me. And so the outcome, I don't really need to have like the outcome all figured out, because I already see these like really beautiful, God-like, you know, shifts happening in my own life just by shifting in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. What is it? Taste and see. I don't know. I'm trying to use my good Bible scripture.
I love
verses,
it. You're really pulling them out. Good for
I'm
you.
I'm trying. Oh man. Well, Liz, this was a ton of fun. I enjoyed and appreciate our conversation, and enjoyed and appreciate the chapter you contributed to the book. So thank you for taking the time to do that, but also thank you for taking the extra time to then come talk to some random person you don't know for an hour about your chapter.
So oh, thank this was you. Fun. Yeah, this was fun. I think we have some similarities, I know, from our backgrounds, and yeah, this was really fun.
Yeah, I agree. Where would you like people to go if they are interested in following the kind of work that you're doing?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads as Liz Enns Petters, the Deconstructed Mama. And then my co-host and I, Esther Getz, have our podcast, the Deconstructing Mamas podcast. So we're on Facebook and Instagram as Deconstructing Mamas. And our podcasts are, you know, like wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find us. We're on season 4 now, so there's quite a few that you can catch up on if you would like. And you can join us there.
Sweet. Well, listeners, as always, thank you guys so much for hanging out today. Liz, thank you again, and to everybody, go in peace.